from the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont. This is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with author Wendy Sanford, whose new book is These Walls Between Us, a memoir of friendship across race and class, published by She Writes Press. Wendy Sanford grew up in an upper-middle-class, white suburban family in Princeton, New Jersey, and attended private schools throughout her life. During the socially turbulent time of the 1970s, she became a feminist, a lesbian, and a Quaker. A founding member of the Boston Women's Health Book Collective, Wendy co-authored and edited many versions of the women's health and sexuality classic, Our Bodies, Ourselves, from 1973 to 2011. In seminary at Harvard Divinity School in the 80s, she began to read works of women of color as devotional reading to remedy her previous exclusive exposure to white and mostly male authors. She served for nearly a decade in campus ministry in the Boston area. In her 50s, she began to reckon with her own white skin and the benefits that came to her through being white. In 2003, she earned an MFA in writing from Vermont College. She's grateful to her friend Mary Norman for partnering with her to create this book. Wendy lives in Cambridge, Massachusetts with Polly Atwood, her spouse of 41 years. Here's a little information about These Walls Between Us. In the mid-1950s, a 15-year-old African-American teenager named Mary White, who is now Mary Norman, traveled north from Virginia to work for 12-year-old Wendy Sanford's family as a live-in domestic for their summer vacation by a remote New England beach. Over the years, Wendy's family came to depend on Mary's skilled service, and each summer, Mary endured the extreme loneliness of their elite white beachside retreat in order to support her family. As the black help, and that is in quotes, and the privileged white daughter, Mary and Wendy were not slated for friendship, but years later, each divorced, each a single parent. Mary, now a rising officer in corrections, and Wendy, a feminist health activist, they began to walk the beach together after dark, talking about their children and their work, and a friendship began to grow. Based on decades worth of visits, phone calls, letters, and texts between Mary and Wendy, These Walls Between Us chronicles the two women's friendship with a focus on what Wendy characterizes as her oft-stumbling efforts as a white woman to see Mary more fully and to become a more dependable friend. The book examines obstacles created by Wendy's upbringing in a narrow white upper-class world, reveals realities of domestic service rarely acknowledged by white employers, and draws on classic works by the African-American writers whose work informed and challenged Wendy along the way. Though Wendy is the work's primary author, Mary read and commented on every draft, and together the two friends hope their story will incite and support white readers to become more informed and accountable friends across the racial divides created by white supremacy, and to become active in the ongoing movement for racial justice. When I spoke with Wendy Sanford, she began by reading two short sections of her new memoir, and I'm going to start by playing those. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
I grew up in the Northeast United States amidst white people who thought ourselves a world apart from the white supremacists of the Ku Klux Klan, the violent radical fringe. And yet I grew up embedded in racist violence myself, just of a variety that was polite and normalized in American life, in which every institution advanced white people at the expense of people of color. I also toddled my first steps into a fraught zone between my white mother's blue blood owning class family and my white father's hard scrabble farm, Georgia roots. I channeled both my mother's assumptions of superiority and my father's urgent, resentful aspiration to rise. My parents united in the project of training me to become a white upper-class wealthy woman. They only half succeeded. As an adult, I thrived in the women's health movement, joined the Quakers, immersed myself in writings by people of color, and fell in love with a woman. I'm grateful to the many magnets that drew me outside my family's elite bubble and landed me in a more humane life. Most centrally, I am grateful to Mary Norman, whose friendship is the magnet that has mattered the longest. More than 60 years ago, in the mid-1950s, a young African-American teenager named Mary White traveled north from Virginia to work for my family as a live-in domestic worker during our summer vacation. Mary was 15, I was 12. As the Black, quote-unquote, help and the privileged white daughter, we were not slated for friendship. Employers like my mother used the word friend to manage domestic workers, not to connect with them. Soon, however, came the dynamic social movements of the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, the civil rights movement, multiracial feminism, and liberation theology. These movements opened friendship as a possibility between Mary and me. We stepped into that opening. Across the stark differences of race and class between us, we began to shape a bond. Some 30 years after we met, in the late 1980s, Mary declared that we should write a book about our friendship. She, more than I, understood how many rules of the dominant culture we had violated in our journey towards becoming friends. Unwritten rules of domestic service, carefully policed barriers between white and Black, between rich and poor. No one will believe our story, she said. At the time, we had been sharing novels and essays by Toni Morrison, Pauli Marshall, Alice Walker, Audre Lorde, and Alice Childress. Especially electrifying for us both was Anne Moody's Coming of Age in Mississippi, which Mary said came the closest to expressing her own experiences growing up Black in the rural South. I had worked with a team of women as co-author and editor of Our Bodies Ourselves, a feminist resource on women's health and sexuality. All this made Mary's suggested writing project seem possible. We even fantasized being invited by Oprah to appear on her new at the time TV show. These Walls Between Us is not the book Mary and I imagined we might write together. The book would not exist without Mary, based as it is on innumerable conversations between us by phone, in person, via email, and in later years via texting. Mary has read and commented on every draft, but These Walls is very much my story. It focuses on my often stumbling journey towards seeing Mary more fully across the socially constructed barriers between us. That is, towards being a truer friend. It is written with a white readership in mind to invite white readers to join me in exploring our relationship to white supremacy culture. It's 2020 as I finish this book. Mary is 80 years old. I am 76. On weekly phone calls, we carry on about politics and family like the observant, caring old women we are. As we vented about the Trump presidency, Mary said of the book, I think of the climate we are living in now, all the hateful things mostly young white males are doing that fall into the category of hate crimes, putting a wedge between people. The people who elected President Trump want to take the country back to the good old days. This book can show what those days were really like. For my part, I hope These Walls Between Us will also be a testament to the power of love that has kept us, each in our own way, reaching across the obstacles arrayed against our becoming close. I hope that it will inspire readers to examine the barriers and possibilities in their own cross-racial and cross-class relationships.
Wonderful. Do you want to go to chapter 5?
So when I was 19 years old and got engaged, which is wildly early as from my current thinking, I had a wedding in that same place on that island of Nantucket. And my mother begged Mary to come. Mary was by then working in corrections in New Jersey. She was the first female officer in the whole system of the Mercer County Corrections. And she was busy and she had kids, but my mother begged Mary to come to help me get married. And so Mary came. She sacrificed a lot to come. And my mother paid her, but money didn't match what Mary gave up in terms of being with her children. So during my wedding week, this short scene takes place during my wedding week and says something about the title of the book. The scene takes place in the cottage that my parents rented year after year. And I'm just coming home from some errands.
Okay.
Coming home from town at midday, passing outside the open windows of the dining room and kitchen, I heard my mother and Mary talking. My mother was speaking in her conversation voice, not the voice she used when reviewing Mary's tasks. Through the window, I could see Mom in her usual spot at the dining room table, leaning back comfortably against the wall shared by the kitchen. My mother used that seat so she could tap on the wall at dinner, telling Mary when it was time to clear the table or bring more food. Usually shut, because my mother liked it that way, the door between the dining room and kitchen was now wide open. Passing by the kitchen window on my way to the back door, I could hear Mary saying something back to my mother. Not "yes, ma'am," or "will you have more iced tea," but one relaxed, casual sentence, then another. Mary sat with her own lunch at the kitchen table, back to back, dining room to kitchen. My mother and Mary were having lunch and talking. With a testy and critical husband and a self-involved daughter, my mother seemed to be benefiting from Mary's listening and kind attention. The unwritten rules of domestic service and toxic dividers of race and class put the kindest person in the house on the other side of a wall. Mary jumped to her feet when I entered through the kitchen door. "Please finish your lunch," I said, but Mary remained standing. As I joined my mother in the dining room, Mary swung the kitchen door slowly shut behind me. The brief moment of informal exchange between my mother and Mary, their lunch together on opposite sides of the kitchen wall, had ended.
Thank you so much for reading that. And I love your title, and I love that that scene gives us a little actual image to go with it. I mean, it's a wonderful metaphor anyway, but it's not a metaphor, is it? It's just truly how that played out.
Yeah.
In the intro, you mention that the book that was initially discussed was something Mary came up with, and then this is a different book than that would have been, and this is your story. So how did that change happen? How did you come to write this book, and how did it come to be the book that it is now, as opposed to Mary saying, "We really should write a book about our friendship"?
Yes. Well, it took more than 30 years to write, so it's a very long answer, but I'll try to give it. I'll try to give it efficiently.
Okay.
When we started this out, Mary was working 2 and 3 jobs always to support her family. And I had leisure time. I didn't work full time. I had a college education, which she had been totally robbed of. And I had majored in English, and I thought, okay, I'll write our book. Well, there were a lot of white people back then who probably thought that, oh yeah, I can write a book for me and you know, whatever black people I want to write about. But in fact, I learned over the next 30 years what kind of arrogance lay in feeling that I could write our book. So part of why it took so long was, well, we tried doing interviews. I tried interviewing her once on tape. But again, I didn't stop to study oral history. So I just said, oh, start at the beginning. Tell me where you were born and blah, blah, blah. And well, that is not what she wanted to really talk about. And so it was a kind of a failed moment in oral history. And she didn't have time to tape herself. And so I just started taking notes every time we talked on the phone or met or, you know, went visited each other's homes or whatever. Finally, just a few years ago, when texting started, Mary started to, it's like she found her writer voice finally. I mean, she hated writing. She hates it. She had a terrible education in a one-room schoolhouse.
In Virginia, right?
Rural Virginia. And she just, it was fine with both of us, kind of, that I was writing our book. But it just became more obvious that that wasn't authentic. That wasn't right. I couldn't claim Mary's voice. And so the book gradually although now it has much more of her voice in it, which is really important, mainly through texting. Right. She'll say, ask me anything you want. And I'll say, okay, this, this, and this. And she'll just answer by texting.
Right.
So it's not coming through. It's still coming through my questions, but it's not coming through my hand, my writing.
Yeah. And absolutely. It's a story of friendship. It's a story of the friendship that the two of you share. But it was just interesting to me to find out how it, you know, became a project that you kind of took on. And that makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
Yeah. And finally, we just had to be honest. You know, I'll say one more thing about it. I realized a couple of years ago that if I had, because what I did have that Mary didn't have was disposable income, I could have found an oral historian, preferably an African-American woman, who would ask Mary about her life, and the book could have grown out of both our voices in a more authentic way. But by then she was like 80 and I was 76, and we were done. This was what we could do for this time around in our lives. So yeah. I really did shift it to what I had to learn about her life, because I grew up, her job involved learning everything about me.
Yeah.
My role involved, she was invisible. I was involved focusing on myself and my own life,
right,
so that
right.
It took all these years of reading and thinking and learning what her life is really like.
So let's give a little background for listeners about what your initial relationship was. She was someone that your mother was put in touch with, who could come and work in your household as a domestic worker.
During a summer vacation, yes, in 1956.
So I wonder if you can talk a little bit about your upbringing, Wendy, and the role that your parents played in both the friendship that you share with Mary and the walls that existed between you until you were able to kind of figure out how to navigate that.
Oh, that's such a good question. I grew up in an upper middle class white family in suburban in Princeton, New Jersey. And as I said in the introduction, my mother had always been kind of blue blood, upper crust, old money, as they used to say. And my father was more aspiring and kind of resented my mother's sense of superiority, I think. But they were, you know, they were training me to be an upper class woman, through education, through clothing, through manners, through taste. Oh my heavens, how taste can be a weapon. And I think when Mary was 15 when she came that first summer, and then she came lots of other summers up till, you know, in her 40s, 50s. She was 15, I was 12. And my mother was probably happy that I was friendly to Mary, but she, even as we started becoming much closer in our late 30s, early 40s, my mother would say, well, I hope you'll see some of your friends this summer. You know, I'd go for vacation and mainly want to see Mary and talk with Mary and walk on the beach with Mary. And I think my mother didn't think of Mary in the same category as my other friends.
Right. Which is really interesting because she loved Mary and Mary loved her. And you have this great moment really early in the book where your mother, you write, in a small vase on the bedside table, I noticed three daisies and a wild rosebud that my mother must have picked and placed there that morning. So that was in Mary's room. So your mother put a little vase of flowers in her room. And I loved that from the start, you offer a somewhat complex picture of your mother. She is kind to Mary within the confines of what she sees as appropriate.
Exactly.
But she's not seeing her as a whole person. And that was very interesting. Was it difficult for you to decide how to portray your parents in writing this? And, you know, you expose some private stories. There's some domestic violence in mm-hmm. your family mm-hmm. story. Mm-hmm. But also, was it hard to figure out how to cast the
story of your privilege, their privilege, and you know, did you ever kind of go back and forth between I'm being too easy on them, I'm being too hard on them?
You know, totally, what I mean? Totally. Yeah. There's even a moment in the book where I say it's so tempting, as I'm talking about examples of the racism that they had learned and they were expressing about Mary. It's so tempting to just fix them with a pin, like a insect on a, you know, a sample insect that you're studying, and just kind of splay them out. But in fact, that would be so self-righteous. And so really what I was up against was my own self-righteousness, my tendency, the very human tendency to blame somebody. I mean, memoir is so boring if it's blaming somebody.
Right.
You know, if there's a villain, you know, it's like I really wanted to portray my parents' humanity and also their limits. Mm-hmm. You know, Toni Morrison said, her character at the end of The Bluest Eye said, love is never any better than the lover.
Mm.
And in some ways, this book traces my effort to be a better lover.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Not in a sexual sense, but in a deeper
right.
sense.
Right.
And so, yes, I really, they were so complex.
Yeah.
And their alcoholism added to that. And I didn't want to make them villains. I just wanted to make them real people whose love was so limited.
Yeah.
Love towards Mary was so limited.
And it's sad. I think they would have been happier people if they had been able to accept her fully as you know, the real person she was. I love, I love how you have this ability to provide stories that build the friendship up for us, but you'll provide context, and then all of a sudden you give us a different lens to look through. And I loved that. So one thing you did, for example, you described the journey that Mary took to come to Nantucket the first time. And as you say, she's 15 years old. I doubt she's been very far from home ever. I don't remember, but I don't think so. She has to take a boat, and she has to ride in a car with a white policeman. And oh my goodness. And you know, I'm sure your parents thought that they had set things up so that she would be safe and delivered to them, you know, securely. Mm-hmm. But, mm-hmm. And so you give us this context of what she went through, and I'm thinking, okay, so her parents are really trying to look out for her. But of course, how terrifying. She can't swim and she's on a boat.
Mm-hmm.
White men are dangerous in the first place, let alone white policemen. And so you're
in the South, yeah.
Yeah. And so you give us this wonderful context and then this other lens. And it really kind of builds a full story about what happened, but also about your privilege and your parents' privilege and the inability to see that they weren't really taking into account what might be her best interests all the time, even though they tried.
Yes, that's so well said.
You're also very straightforward about your own complicity as a young woman. And, you know, it's through ignorance. But again, I think that must have been very hard to figure out how to paint yourself.
Yes. You know, Sue Williams Silverman.
She's been on the show a couple times, too.
Well, she taught me a lot about memoir. And she said that in memoir, you have the voice of innocence and the voice of experience. She said one of her memoirs took her at least 5 years to find the voice of experience that would work. And I would say I took 30 years to find the voice of experience that would work. So that when I look back now, it's so great with memoir because you really try to give the original scene, you do it full bodied and give the sense that, you know, the smells and the colors and the lived experience of it. And then you revisit it with a different lens. And my voice of experience could easily have been, and probably was for a while, like self-blaming, like I was so stupid. Well, that doesn't help anybody grow to have that kind of blame. So I really just had to lift up everybody's humanity as best as I could and be really honest about the things I didn't see at the time. And then to do some teaching about how I learned. So I do draw in a lot of works by writers
yes.
who taught me, because, you know, there's this thing that we all say in white anti-racism work, which is learn all you can, but don't ask your Black friends to teach you. Because they don't owe you that. They're with their discretionary time. They're living their lives. So I did really a lot of reading to learn so that I would be able to be a more dependable friend to Mary, I think. Uh-huh. So my voice of experience, which I tried so many different approaches, actually had to be multi-layered. So there's what I'm thinking and learning as I grow, but there's also the books that helped me and the stories in those books that particularly helped me see something about Mary's life that I hadn't noticed.
Right. Now, you talk about a book called, I think this was a study, I assume it became a book, Between Women, Domestics and Their Employers. And that was Dr. Judith Rollins, is that right?
Yes, who wrote
that? That sounds like that was very helpful to you.
Totally.
Do you want to talk a little bit about?
Yes, because she was a sociology. She was getting her doctorate in sociology way back when, and she wanted to study the relationship between black domestics and white employers, domestic workers, and white employers. So she's African American. She posed as a domestic worker in several families in the Boston area. And also, as a researcher, did a bunch of a whole lot of interviews, and this book came out of it. And
that was, when did she do that?
That was back, I think, maybe in the 70s,
okay.
Something like that.
Okay.
But I sent her my book. She's a professor emerita from Wellesley now, and I sent her my book and just held my breath, and. She thinks it makes a contribution to understanding the divisions that are at work.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And the hierarchies that are at work. And yeah. She gave a blurb for the book, and she's just, she's my hero. I mean, it was such an important, groundbreaking book that she wrote several decades ago.
Now, can you talk a little bit about some of the other research that you did? You say you've read quite a bit. Did you interview people other than Mary?
I didn't. It's mostly reading fiction. You know, it's like fiction is where you learn so much. So I read works by Toni Morrison.
Mm-hmm.
And I gave a list. Alice Childress wrote this wonderful book back in the 50s in the voice of an African-American domestic worker named Mildred, I think, who she's just really, she has a real critique of the white family and of the particularly the woman who employs her. And it's just a really sharp, funny, lively critique.
Yeah.
So that was a really long time ago. She was writing it at the time that I was meeting Mary, but I had no idea of all those rules of domestic service at the time.
I also loved yet another layer. I like that word because you have a lot of layers, not just in your own voice of experience, but in the way that you've structured this and what you include. I love how you blend history and story. One example comes soon after Mary arrives in your household. You kind of zoom out and you offer the historical context about what was going on at the time. You talk about authoring Lucy and segregated public schooling, nonviolent resistance of activists, Rosa Parks, and the bus boycott, which was taking place that summer when Mary first came to you. The bus boycott is going on. And then you write, I love this, I just laughed out loud, this was so perfect. You write, when we met in my mother's kitchen that summer, Mary and I came from different countries. And that was so great because it's right on the heels of all of this information that, of course, you as a 12-year-old knew nothing about, probably, mostly.
Yes, right.
Although I think you started following some of the news a little bit around then, right? Your father would ask you if you knew anything about it.
He would quiz me about current events, but he never once mentioned the civil rights movement.
Oh, okay.
Nothing.
Okay.
He read what was at the time a pretty conservative newspaper. And so they did not educate me at all about what was going on particularly in the South.
So at what point in your relationship did you start speaking up to them about your growing understanding of what your thoughts actually were?
You know, to be honest, I didn't that much. Alcoholic families are tricky.
Yeah.
And but I remember saying to my dad, I remember one morning he was saying, the American Negro is the problem with American education. And I said, yeah, American education has a Negro problem. And I said, you know, Black people have an education problem with what's not what's not provided. And I said, I told him that for several centuries, it had been illegal to teach a Black person to read. And he wouldn't believe it. He would not believe it. And about, I don't know, 25 years later, much later in his life, he wrote me and he said, I finally realized, I finally ascertained that you were right, that it was a crime to teach a Black person to read and a crime for a Black person to read. So, but so that I didn't fight with them because he was too kind of dangerous to fight with.
Right.
But I did. That's the kind of thing I did.
It's interesting that he wrote to you.
I know. Wasn't that great?
Yeah.
It's like we all can change a little bit later on.
A little bit. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Let's see. Do you think there was a certain moment in time when you began to have a somewhat concrete awakening about race, or was it just very gradual?
So I became a feminist health activist was a major part of my life.
Yes.
And I was in a group, Our Bodies, Ourselves group, and we were all white women at first. For a long time, we were only white women. And it was that heady time in second wave feminism when we felt like we could say, we women this and we women that. And we were so excited to be united with all women. And we were not realizing the race and class differences. And now we would say gender differences, too, that that meant we couldn't say we, and we couldn't speak for all women. And at that time in the 70s, there were very active groups of African-American women in particular, the Combahee River Collective, and then the National Black Women's Health Project that we helped to, you know, fund a bit. And then they, you know, just challenged us and said, Black women, for instance, African-American women in this country have health concerns that you're not focusing on. If you just focused on abortion, as important as it is, you're leaving out that many women in poverty, that women all have the right to have children if they want to, and to have a supported situation so they can feed their kids and raise their kids in security. And or sterilization abuse is a terrible abuse that's going on in Puerto Rico and with other Latinas in this country. And you need to focus on that just as much as the issues that affect you as middle-class white women. Mm-hmm. So that's where my education started.
Okay.
And so, and then since I knew and loved Mary, something caught for me. And then when I went to seminary and took this fabulous course on ethics taught through the lives of Black women through in literature, when I started doing that reading, and of course the civil rights movement was very, very active, then I went to seminary and started learning about a liberation theology. And it all kind of came together. And my partner, Polly, and I helped a group get together of white women to talk about whiteness and about racism. Mm-hmm. So that was early. That was in the early 80s. Mm-hmm. And so it's been an important pursuit, really, ever since then.
Okay, wonderful. Now, you just mentioned your background in women's health. And I did want to ask you about Our Bodies, Ourselves. So you were one of 12 women who wrote Our Bodies, Ourselves, which when I first met you, that just completely, I wanted to just follow you around.
I was one of 12 original members, kind of founder member authors, but there are so many more authors
so many more, sure.
over the years.
Yeah.
And then I became an editor to kind of try to get the voices of as many women and the concerns of as many women as possible into the book. So I worked, it was really my life work.
Yeah. Now, and I'm just wondering if you can talk a little bit about that project. Now you've just said it was your life work, I was going to say, and how has it affected your life? But just maybe talking a little bit about the beginnings of that, how you cover that in this book, but if I think people might be interested to hear a little bit more about that.
Okay, well, I got married at age 20 and to a white architect, person in architecture school. And we owned a house together, and his mother and my mother just felt like it was time for me to have a baby. I really didn't, I had done so well in college and I just didn't think of going to work or what work I might do. So I had a baby and all of a sudden was incredibly depressed. I would lie around. I'd wait for his naps. I'd lie on the living room floor and cry. It's just like, and my husband, who was as uneducated about postpartum as I was, thought it was, here you wanted a baby and now you're not happy. What's going on? So it was a very difficult time. And a few months into that, a friend of mine that I knew through actually my husband's architecture class that he was in, took me to this group of women who were looking into women's health. And I wouldn't have gone on my own because, you know, when you're depressed, you don't go out to things that might really help. So she, right. Esther, picked me up and took me there to the second meeting because I hadn't shown up at the first one. And they were talking about sex, and I was like so kind of shy and embarrassed and didn't say a word. They were saying words like clitoris and orgasm and things I had never heard said out loud before. And then we broke into small groups, which is also a pedagogy I'd never participated in before. And so I was in a small group in a classroom at MIT, and it was a group of women, mostly mothers. And I looked around to see if they seemed happy because I was so unhappy. And so we talked about orgasm when we did. I learned some great, very interesting stuff about sex. But then we started talking about postpartum depression, which is another word I had never heard before. And that by the end of that conversation, I understood that I was going through something that many women had gone through that had physical reasons, but also social reasons, like the isolation in this house that with just me, once my husband went back to work, et cetera, and that it wasn't my fault. And that was very profound for me because I had been blaming myself, and my husband certainly had too, like, why aren't you happy? You wanted a baby. And, mm-hmm. you know, people talk about that second wave feminism, like the aha moment, when something shifts for you. And that was my shift. I realized that, and one of the women in the group, Paula, said, well, I'm researching postpartum depression so I can teach other people about it so women don't have to go through what I went through. And that's when I became involved with Our Bodies Ourselves, and I still am. You know, it's just, it was a profound moment of change and for me.
Wonderful. That's great. Let's see. Now, you divorced and then you came out as a lesbian after becoming involved in that group. And you write about your own internalized homophobia, which was interesting to me. I think part of what was interesting to me is that you were coming up against different prejudices at the same time that you were kind of awakening to your own lack of understanding of racial pressures that someone like Mary was under. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's so important to you personally that you had your own sort of internalized homophobia. And I wonder if you ever put that together as sort of like the all the different prejudices that we grow up with, that we inherit.
Yes. And that you really carry them inside yourself so deeply.
Yeah.
You know, everything with internalized homophobia, everything I'd seen as a girl was, you know, you want to you want to find a husband and you want to have a boyfriend and you want to get married and have children. And that marriage looked just like a man and a woman back then. And it gets so reinforced by everything you see that you just do carry it within you. So that when I realized that I was attracted to women, it just felt, and then particularly in love with this wonderful person I'm still with 42 years later, there's something inside you that just almost like revolts against it or finds it unacceptable. So it's like that you're getting a lot of that message from the outside world, we carry it inside ourselves. And I think that helped me understand that Toni Morrison's novel, The Bluest Eye, is really such a powerful evocation around internalized racism. Mm-hmm. The little girl who feels if she could just disappear or go to sleep and wake up with blue eyes, mm-hmm. she'd be beautiful. Mm-hmm. That's like so many layers to that. But I feel like my own experience of internalized homophobia helped me to open my eyes to the impact of internalized racism. Mm-hmm. On Black people, and then also that white people also internalize racism. And that's why it isn't just a matter of changing your mind.
Right.
You really have to just reach in deep and find some of those images that just for example, the way Black men have been seen as criminals. That goes so deep that if a white person sees a Black man walking towards her, the first thought is not reality.
Right.
It's fear. And actually, who really was dangerous in our history? It was white people were dangerous to Black people.
Right.
And then that gets turned around and we take it in through all the stories and all the films and all, you know, all the things we've heard said as white people. And so it's deep. It's the you know, there's this term unlearning racism. It's like, it goes very, very deep. And I think I understand it a tiny bit better because I've had to unlearn homophobia mm-hmm. inside myself also. Mm-hmm. So that's a very interesting question. Thank
yeah.
you.
Yeah. Now, I loved reading about Mary's career in the prison system. And mm-hmm. she became a guard, like a security guard in the prison system.
She became a guard and then went to officer training school as
right.
the first woman to do that. Yes.
Right. And then she had a very
became an officer.
And a successful career in that line. And then the other thing that I loved, I believe I'm remembering this correctly, you write in the book about Mary actually having been the one to kind of break down these walls between you and to kind of truly open up the possibility of friendship. It sounds like that was, am I right in remembering that she invited you to stay?
The fact that she was willing for me to bumble along in my ignorance, trying to be her friend, that patience and that love is absolutely foundational to our friendship.
Yeah.
In that way, that's really
what
true.
I'm remembering something wrong. I don't know. I jotted down.
Oh, I know. Oh, yes. She was the first one to visit overnight.
She visited
in the
you.
Other person's home. She visited me and Polly in Cambridge. I had visited her many times, but never to stay over.
Oh, okay.
So she was the first one to make that long trip to our home in Cambridge and stay for the weekend. So she did, yes, she took that step. That's exactly right.
Okay. All right, great. Let's see. I always like to ask my guests what they've been reading lately that they might recommend to listeners. You've mentioned The Bluest Eye and a couple of other works. Is there anything you've read recently that you might add to that list?
Oh, well, Polly and I both just finished. I really like reading fiction by African-Americans. You know, the whole first part of my life, I read all books by white men, really.
Yeah.
And that's what majoring in English. Yes, yes, exactly. And so I'm still.
It's like all the white men and then Virginia Woolf. Okay.
Exactly. And maybe Emily Dickinson.
There you go.
So the two of the books I would recommend, one is called The Other Black Girl. It was written by Zakiya Delilah Harris, a young woman who worked in publishing in New York City for a long time as one of the only Black people in an office. And it's a fabulous rendition of the unconscious racism that goes on and conscious racism that goes on in those offices for the only Black person working there. But it's also a horror story. It's a real horror story. He's a horror story on a couple of different levels. And right. It's a great read. And then the other one that I would recommend came out a couple of years ago. And it's called Such a Fun Age by a woman named Kylie Reed, who worked as an African-American woman, worked as a nanny to work her way through college and I think graduate school. And it's, again, such a send up of that situation where there's a Black nanny for a white family. And it's just such a lively book.
Okay.
So those are two that I would recommend that are, you and I are, you're a fiction writer. I'm a fiction lover. It's hard to get myself to read nonfiction. So it's so interesting that I wrote nonfiction. But memoir, as we learned in school, is memoir uses all the tools of fiction to deliver a personal story. So right. That's what I tried to do.
Right. Now, what are you writing next?
I don't know. Aren't I old enough not to have to think about that?
It's totally up to you.
So I was faithful for many, many years to this. I'm a Quaker and we have this thing called leadings where we feel like we're being nudged by the spirit to do something that might be hard, but that we're just being asked to do it. And that's how I felt about this book. And oh my heavens, when I finished the book, to realize that to keep being faithful to it, I had to figure out about publicity. So I'm so busy trying to figure out how to get word out about this book that I haven't thought about what's next. But I just am reading George Saunders' book called, what is it?
A Swim in the Pond.
Yes, the Rain.
In the Rain. Wonderful.
Oh, about short story writing. So who knows I've never been that successful with writing short fiction. But
are you reading that on the page or are you listening to it?
Oh, I'm reading it on the page.
He reads it. If you like audiobooks, it's really good. He's got a great voice and his humor really comes well through.
Oh, good. Good.
Reading. Yeah. Yeah.
Good. So he reads the stories aloud to you?
Well, no, actually, he reads his prose aloud.
Yes.
And I'm trying to remember, he may have read one of the stories, but I think he also has other actors reading some of the
reading
stories.
Reading the stories. Yeah.
It's very good. I love that. I love that. Okay, well, so I always finish these interviews, Wendy, by asking for advice for other writers. And in your case, I tend to frame it, but you're welcome to go outside this frame, okay?
Okay.
But in your case, I wondered if you have advice for empathizing beyond our own experiences in order to better understand somebody else, which can be very helpful in writing anything because a lot of our characters are from outside of our experiences. So that's one thing I thought of. But if you have something else that you would say to offer advice to other to listeners who are writers, that would be great.
Well, I'll start with that. I think you build empathy through reading fiction. I'm repeating myself, but I just if there's a whole group or whole experience that you're trying to understand and more deeply and would like to write about it in some way or reflect it accurately in your writing, there are so many writers out there who have written from the heart about, you know, written their life experiences into their characters and into their plots and into their. So that's just that really fed my empathy so, so deeply. And I think movies too, you know, movies too.
Yeah.
If you can get behind the construction part to the story or the hype part. Well, I guess I'd have to say keep at it. I mean, after 30 years working on this project, you know, keep at it and keep coming back to it. I also was able to pay for a writing coach. I'm immensely grateful to A.J. Verdell, who wrote the book 20 years ago, The Good Negress, a really powerful novel, and is a writing teacher that I met at Fine Arts Work Center. And she worked with me for several years, actually, on this book. And so I think if you can get coaching, maybe mutually with somebody else, if the money is an issue, which it so often is, because writers don't get paid much at all.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So get help, read a lot.
And persevere.
And persevere. There you go. There you
That's
go.
That's wonderful. All right. I want to mention again, the name of the book is These Walls Between Us. Written by Wendy Sanford, who's been my guest today, and published by She Writes Press. Wendy, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Shayla. It's so good to see you.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont. Streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. And that was an interview with Wendy Sanford. The excerpts that she read were from These Walls Between Us, a memoir of friendship across race and class, published by She Writes Press. You can learn more about her work at wendysanford-thesewallsbetweenus.com. And on Wendy Sanford's website, you can go to a page titled Meet Mary Norman, which is a wonderful spot to learn more about her friend Mary. On that page are a series of events that shaped Mary Norman's life and the people that she worked with. She worked in New Jersey Corrections from 1968 to 1993. And these are really interesting stories that highlight her contributions to that industry. Just for example, when she was punished for her belief in prisoner rehabilitation, she turned this demeaning demotion that she was given into a job where she developed a training program to teach inmates who are about to be released how to prepare for their next steps, such as filling out work applications and dressing for interviews and things like that. So just an interesting and inspiring story. And this week's Write the Book prompt is to navigate to that site and read about Mary Norman and her work. If you are moved to do so, then you could write a poem, a story, or an essay about whatever comes to mind. Maybe you could write from the point of view of a prisoner who had to learn how to dress for an interview, for example. Or you could write from the perspective of a racist guard who didn't like the fact that Mary supervised his work and then eventually came to like and respect the way she supported him. That's another story on that page. I hope that, like me, you will be inspired by what you learn and that you will want to write something. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. I don't know if I have time to finish out the show, but you know it all probably. I share writing prompts on my podcast site. I'd love your feedback about the show. Be sure to tell your friends. Visit on Twitter and Facebook, Write the Book, and rate us and talk about us and tell people. WriteTheBook.podbean.com is the podcast site. From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book. Have a great week.